people who love them.
Hello, this is The Thing About Cars, recording at Strongbox West. This is Mickey at the table I've got.
Becca.
And Ben.
And I think we should just jump right in. And I saw a pretty bad accident on the road the other day, and I stopped to help folks. And thankfully, nothing was really, really serious about this accident. Basically, a semi had hit two vehicles and treated one of them like a child's play toy and dragged it across the interstate and smashed it into a retaining wall. Luckily, no one died. One person was somewhat hurt. I'm pretty sure she had multiple fractures and a tiny little cut somewhere on her body, but otherwise she was fine. But I gotta hand it to airbags and seatbelts for doing their jobs. The lady who got most of the hit was in a back seat without a seatbelt, so you know she got transported to a hospital somewhere. But it made me want to go through just some general guidelines on what people should do if they actually should see an accident. Do you have any idea of what the standards are for that sort of thing, or what you encourage? What would you do if you were to stop?
Right away, call 911.
Yeah.
Right away.
Make sure you're safe.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what I did. I put my car way out of the way, and yeah. I walked on, and I'm like, it was kind of chaotic. There were people there who were like, oh my God, I saw this, and you saw that, and like, can you believe all this? I'm like, look, who's hurt and who's not? And I had to point to someone to say, you call 911, and then they finally did it. I like to encourage my friends to take basic first aid classes, you know, because what happened, God forbid you ever need the skills, right? But if you do need them, you know, I'm glad no one tried to move this lady out of that back seat. I think she would have been yeah. much worse off if they actually had pulled her out of there.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
So, but I think basic first aid is always a good thing to get prepared on long before you ever need it. Take your entire family out. I know Red Cross does classes like this all the time. I don't know who else does safety stuff. But I'm looking at a cheat sheet here. We looked up and on an insurance company's website, they actually have a list of these things that you should do. And so far, we're right on target. First of all, ensure your safety first. Turn on your hazard lights. Get out of the way of any fuel leaks or broken glass or anything. They say call 911 immediately, which we've said. Then they say check on the victims, which we have already said. They say don't, under any circumstances, do not move an injured person. And, of course, right. in first aid training, they tell you move an injured person if their life is in further danger. But otherwise, don't move an injured person. This webpage says something interesting. It says stabilize the vehicles if you can. And I think that means simply turning off the car and putting them in park for the most part.
Yeah, apply the parking brake or something.
Exactly. But it also says doing so will eliminate the risk of fires, especially since chances are good that the crashes may have caused an oil leak or a fuel leak or something like that. And then the last thing is to give a statement and provide your contact information. I'm a little shocked at the idea that the first person on the scene simply whipped out her phone and started filming it. But
oh, wow. That's really...
yeah. But I pointed to two people. I said, you know, the two guys who were ranting about what they saw, I said, hey, please go talk to the lady with the phone. And then when the first policeman arrived on the scene, I said, she's got all the information all you need on her phone. So hopefully they got everything they needed mm-hmm. off of her phone. But yeah, I mean, I guess that's it. You know, it was, there were about six of us that actually pulled over to do this thing. And then as soon as they shut down the interstate to do cleanup, I got out of there. But yeah, so if you are out there, you know, once again, just the never-ending reminder for me that it only takes a second to really mess up your day. Not to mention your life, and to be prepared and get some first aid training and help others out whenever you can, but do it safely. So, having said that, what else do we want to talk about today?
Well, you were saying you wanted to put an electric supercharger on your Mazda, didn't you?
It sounds like I need that for my Honda.
Yeah. Let's all get electric superchargers.
All right, cool.
So what is an electric supercharger? How does it differ from a normal supercharger?
Well, it's driven by an electric motor instead of by directly from the engine's power.
Right. So it actually is more effective than a belt-driven supercharger.
Well, not necessarily. I don't know a great deal about them. I haven't researched them, but there are a couple of advantages. Well, one, you're not dragging any crank power directly to its drive. The electric motor is its own power source. Of course, the electric motor needs power as well, so you're going to need a pretty stout electrical system in the car. I don't know the exact requirements, but you know, this could put a little drag on your alternator, but I wouldn't think it'd be terrible if they're selling these things successfully. But other advantages include things like physical mounting. If you've got a car that's pretty tight under the bonnet, you might be able to get away with this where you might not with any other supercharger. One big advantage over a turbocharger is, you know, the conventional turbocharger is exhaust driven, is that with this electric supercharger, you don't have nearly the heat issues you'd have with a turbocharger.
Okay. So do you think there's enough room under the hood of the Mazda to do one of these things?
We'll have to look and see. We'll see what the product dimensions are, and where there's a will, there's a way.
Sure, I'm sure.
In fact, you know, we could probably, worst come to worst, there's probably all kinds of space behind the plastic in the front end where with a little bit of creative plumbing, you know, we could make it work.
I don't know. I think Becca's right. Let's do it to the Civic first.
Yeah, okay. That's cool with me. I'm skimming an article on Car Throttle, but
what's it say?
Some of it is beyond my car knowledge.
Oh, yeah. They've got a lot of little colored things with numbers in the...
I'm still a little new to the car stuff, but, you know,
right, yeah.
Learn something every day.
You know, a long time ago, I used to go to Nobe Nationals to see what people had done to their cars. And there was a lot of really interesting stuff out there on the field. I don't know if you've ever been to tune into the tuner community and everything that they do to their rice burners. I should not use that term. I think that term's now pejorative, isn't it?
I don't know. I think it's kind of embraced by a certain crowd.
You think so?
My boyfriend calls them ricers, but he calls it that with a negative connotation.
Well, I do not mean it with a negative connotation. I have nothing but respect for those cars, and I think they're fun to drive, and I love talking to people about them, so maybe, you know, if...
And while a lot of the things that those guys do are not my personal taste, I still admire them because they're taking a car, a little four-door Civic or Corolla. This is a car that's not made
to
be
exciting.
They're
just like... jamming it out.
This is a car that's made to be basic transportation, you know, and they're really going beyond the engineering intentions of it.
Right.
They're changing that car's paradigm completely. So, at least the ones who do anything under the skin, a lot of them, if they spent the money under the skin that they spent on those spoilers and wings and things, you know, but the ones who do really get into the performance aspect, I admire them because they're doing that with a car that's just really not designed for that.
Yeah, I think it's super cool. Absolutely. So, yeah.
No, I have a super curmudgeonly friend of mine who will remain nameless, who said, why would you do that? Why would you buy a $12,000 car and just trick it out and do all these different things to it and blah, blah, blah?
It's fun.
Yeah, no, her next line was, you don't see buying, you know, $50,000 and $60,000 cars doing the same thing, do you? And nowadays you do. You do see those people who are, you know, they're putting custom stuff on a super expensive car. But, I mean, that's the whole point. You don't buy, generally speaking, you buy the cheaper car in order to do a ton of upgrades to it and turn it into something completely beautiful. But anyway, the tuners, I need to get out and see more of that community this year. Which reminds me, we need to figure out what's on the calendar. If we're not going to Caffeine and Octane this next month in May, I can't go. Hopefully you guys can go.
I might.
I don't know what day it is yet.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'll come across my Facebook.
It's the first Sunday of every... First Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
First Sunday of every month at Perimeter Mall.
Fairly I wait till early. It comes across my Facebook, and then I'm like, sure, I'll go.
We should probably get business cards or something.
Probably. And we won't have this out in time for anybody listening to, you know, be alerted to actually go to it. But this weekend is the British Motor Car Day in Roswell.
Right.
That's on Sunday. You know I will be there.
Yes.
That's this Sunday.
Yes.
Oh, sweet. Okay, cool.
Yeah, that's at, I believe it's at Roswell City Hall in the back parking lot, which doesn't sound very romantic, but it's a parking area with a lot of trees and you know, green islands and things. It's kind of a nice setting. They used to do it at Barry College up in Rome, which is beautiful. It looks like England with the big stone hall and everything, but because it's so far out, people just weren't coming.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they do it in Roswell now, and you'll see everything there from Aston Martin to, you know, Triumph. I can't think of any British car that starts with Z. But, yeah, you'll see it all. You know, Sunbeams and Lotuses and MGs and Land Rovers and Morgans. It's fabulous fun. There's an even bigger one in Norcross in September, but this is the one that's right around the corner.
I can't wait to hear about it.
Yeah, I'll take some pictures, too.
Yeah.
I might be there.
I've had cars at this
before. I know the boyfriend really wants to go, so
hey.
We might take a field trip.
Y'all find me out there.
Yeah, for sure.
Which reminds me, I have in front of me a question.
Uh-oh.
This is about a 1990 Honda Civic SI hatchback.
Oh, wow.
And this person says that their transmission dipstick keeps popping out. It's a poorly written question. Forgive me for insulting you, but it says, the dipstick is popping out. Is there blowback, and can anyone point me in its direction on this type of car? So, the blowback thing is, I thought, was kind of interesting.
So I'd never heard of blowback, and I have a Honda Civic 10 years newer than that. I have a 2000, but Ben here was just explaining it to me a moment ago, and I'm like, I don't think I see anything like that in my car. My neighbor's got a car the generation right before mine. Hers is 96, and I also don't recall seeing something like that in hers either. So.
Yeah, what I was talking about was many transmissions have some form of breather, some way of venting internal pressure, because as the thing operates, it's going to generate heat inside. So the air is going to want to expand, and that has to go somewhere. It might be vented to the engine, or it might not be. Actually, one of my Volkswagens just had a little black plastic cap about, you know, a little less than half inch in diameter that plugged into a hole on top of the transmission. As long as it's in a place where oil won't come out, that's generally okay.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be a blocked breather, and of course, you know, the O-rings that hold the dipstick in might be at fault as well. If the dipstick is vertical and has to go upward to come out, then if it is coming out, I wish the guy had been more specific, but if it's projecting itself out, then pressure may be suspect here.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, I mean, if it is just simply worn out O-rings,
yeah,
and if gravity just isn't holding it in place,
that could be as well, yeah.
Right. But I think the first thing to do is obviously buy a new dipstick and see what happens.
Yeah, or if the O-rings are even replaceable.
Right.
They might be.
Right.
They just might be.
Cool.
I was interested in talking about aftermarket parts because you guys know more about car stuff than me. And a lot of the stuff I've been doing to my 2000 Civic has been with aftermarket parts. You know, because it's such a mass-produced car that I've learned that a lot of stuff I can get made just as well as one I would buy straight from Honda.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only had to get a couple of parts here and there directly from the Honda dealership. But what are your guys' thoughts on that for project cars, on using aftermarket parts? Obviously, you can't do that with some of the newer model cars, but...
Right. Well, it's A-okay in my book.
Because I have definitely found some cheap deals, y'all.
Yeah. So. I mean... My take on it, it simply says it depends on which part you're looking for.
Okay.
And back when I drove a Civic, the Civic community was adamant about sticking with NGK plugs.
Mm-hmm.
They said anything else would strip out the threads.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't buy that.
Well, I'm not entirely sure I buy that, but enough people were saying it to me that it was either a really good rumor or there's some truth to it.
I don't remember if I got NGK or not.
One of the things you have to be careful with those online communities and car forums is a lot of times the only people who use them are kind of the performance geek nut types.
Sure. But Ben, this was pre-internet.
Oh, okay.
So, and NGK was OEM for that car.
Right.
So similarly for my Mazda, Motorcraft is OEM for that car.
Yeah.
And people are like, stick with the OEM plugs. A few people are like, well, yes, that's a double platinum plug. Get the iridium plugs. I'm like,
But as far as the physical fit goes, a spark plug's a spark plug. It's made to a certain physical specification. It's got a certain diameter and thread pitch and length. If it's the right heat rating, you know, you should be A-okay.
Right.
Now, there are some subtleties where, like, some older cars may not do so well with some of the really modern plugs just because, you know, your ancient ignition systems, you know, are a little bit electrically different.
Right.
But,
well, I mean, I'm not sure we're answering Becca's question. So.
Right, but to get back to it, for a mass-produced car that there are a million of out there, any over-the-counter part is probably okay. Sure, there can be some quality defects here and there, but as a broad convention, I wouldn't say there's anything wrong with it.
Cool, all right. Well, that's what I'll keep doing then.
Yeah.
I like it.
Well, I mean, again, throwing out just one other anecdote here, which means nothing, but when I was driving the Volvo, they used an aftermarket third-party PMP switch. I think it was the cable, right?
Uh-huh.
And that thing kept on throwing errors. And so we had to go back and get an actual original part, and then it stopped. So I don't know. You know, that one clearly required a Volvo-branded part.
Yeah.
I'm like, especially on older cars that have been taken around the block a few times, do it.
Yeah, and there are some places where you might want to be a little bit careful. Like if you've got a vehicle that's maybe a little bit esoteric, you might want to be a little more careful on the something like, say, your oil filter.
Mm-hmm.
Because just because a filter will physically fit doesn't mean it's the right specification for things like the bypass valve pressure.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of oil filters have a little spring valve inside them so that the filter becomes clogged, they won't completely stop flowing oil. Because you've got to have oil flowing to keep the engine alive. And so they've got this little bypass valve inside. And so, say, the filter clogs up, the bypass valve opens, and oil keeps flowing. It's unfiltered oil, but that unfiltered oil is probably not going to hurt your engine as much as no oil.
Mm-hmm.
So, but different filters have a different pressure specification for that little valve, and depending on what the oil pressure of your given engine is, and it can vary from manufacturer to manufacturer, that could be an issue. If that bypass valve pressure is too low for the standard operating oil pressure range in your car, then you may be getting bypass oil all the time,
right,
which isn't good.
Interesting.
So that's one little thing, you know, but by and large. And
most,
you know,
like if you go to an actual auto parts store, there are people there who will say, yes, this matches manufacturer specs, and if it doesn't, then you're fine.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. Someone must have made a couple mods on my car before I bought it, even though it was just a single owner.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't get all the info from them, but oil filter that matches spec for my car doesn't actually fit in my car. I had to get a different one.
Oh, wow.
My boyfriend's the one who noticed that when we were doing an oil change. So I don't remember what the specific difference is, but or like why, but so... And whoever did the mods on the car, they replaced the air filter with a K&N, which is good because I can keep cleaning it. So.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it won't hurt you, but I've got an opinion about those.
Well, on a used car, not on a new car.
Right. Well, because they claim to be kind of a performance part. They say they flow more air. Well, the reason they flow more air is they don't put as much stuff in the way of the air, which means they don't put as much stuff in the way of catching the particles in the air. And because they load up with the dirt, you know, if you don't clean them all the time, then you will see a performance difference between clean and dirty that's much steeper than what you would get on a regularly changed paper filter. Yeah. A car I used to have came with one, and I took it out and put the paper filter in. It was just so much easier to deal with, in my opinion.
I did like the performance increases that I felt with the K&N filter in both cars that I've put them in. They do take a little more maintenance. But I did read an article. Some guy tried to do some empirical studies on regular filters versus K&N versus something else. And the upshot was still that if you really want to protect your engine and maximize performance, just drop in a brand new regular filter twice as often as you need to.
Because the other thing, too, is modern engines are running on tighter and tighter internal clearances between the moving parts. And you know, one way you can know this is look at the oil that they take. An older car might take, well, if it's a really old car, maybe 2050 back in the flat tappet days, then you're getting down into your 1040 and...
Now it's 520.
Yeah, there are some that even take a zero something.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that.
Yeah, some take a zero in that first number. And when you get into those fives and zeros, you know you've got a very close tolerance engine, in which case you do want as good filtration on the air intake as you can.
So then how often should I be cleaning that filter? Because I don't think I'm cleaning it enough.
K&N says clean it whenever it gets dirty, whenever you can no longer readily discern the mesh from what used to be pink.
Oh. Right?
So when the pink gets brown enough that it camouflages the mesh, that's the guideline I've always heard. Maybe K&N correct.
That sounds reasonable.
I don't regret it. I mean, I like putting the thing on there, but it does take some effort.
Yeah. Okay. And you have to keep it oiled as well, not just clean it.
Yeah, I think I've cleaned it. Yeah. Every 6 months. So
that's good. I do mine once a year.
Then I'm doing good.
You're doing great.
All right, cool.
Yeah. Like, I'm probably going to blow up my car now. So if anyone has anything to say about K&Ns and what I might be doing wrong with mine.
I think the one in my car, it's not actually K&N. It's the other company that's just like them, but they acquired the company. So same difference. I forgot what the name is. The cleaner that I have is K&N, but I did some research and K&N acquired whatever this less expensive brand is.
I know what you're talking about. I can't remember the name.
It starts with an S, I think. Mm. Anyway.
Yeah.
We could go out and look. But.
I'm trying to think of more like Rock Auto, but they do a really good job of outlining a number of different things for each need. And not all of them are OEM parts, and yet all of them seem to work and fit, and their cataloging system is pretty impressive.
That's cool. I've watched YouTubes from A1 Auto a number of times, and they've given... some really good insight too. Really clear, easy to use videos. So A1 Auto, sponsor us, please.
Yes, absolutely.
Send me some wiper blades. I need some.
Oh, okay.
It is supposed to rain tomorrow.
Is it?
Nah. It is, yeah. So
no one can drive in Atlanta tomorrow.
Right, exactly. On that note, let's wish our listeners a good and safe day. If you're in the rain, turn your lights on.
Yes. So
not your hazards,
not
though.
Your hazards, and just be careful, you guys. We'll see you in a week or so. Take care.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.